This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. With a wide range of legislative bills, a number of elections, and talks of tax reform on the table, 2014 could shake out to be an exciting and tumultuous year in Wisconsin politics. State lawmakers head back to the floor next week to begin discussing a number of matters that could shape Wisconsin. Here today to talk about what's in store for Wisconsin politics this year are Democratic State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau and UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of Political Science John Cavari. Thanks so much for joining me today. I should mention that we did invite a number of Republican lawmakers from our area and across the state to join us, but they either declined the invitation or didn't respond to our request. First and foremost, I was hoping we could talk about taxes. I'm not so sure what can actually happen when it comes to tax reform this year before any sort of elections, but we have heard talks about Governor Walker proposing the possibility of eliminating the state's income tax. Let's focus on that first. John, when you first heard that, I guess, what exactly would be the positives and negatives with eliminating an income tax?
Well, there are pros and cons to every tax, and I think we need to acknowledge objectively that there are these strengths and weaknesses for each tax. So I think the concern with the income tax is that it is highly elastic. So when the Great Recession happened, revenues did decline drastically in terms of the income tax, and a little less so in terms of the sales tax. The income tax on the other side of the coin is that it's progressive, meaning that higher income earners are going to be paying a higher tax rate. A sales tax is more regressive, so it hits lower income and middle income families a little bit harder because of kind of the way it's structured. So those are the basic pros and cons of the income tax and the sales tax. Now, from what I understand, to eliminate the income tax, the state would need to increase the sales tax over 13% from where it's at now at about 5.5%.
5.5%, yep.
Here in La Crosse County. So that's a little bit of a concern too. So I think that the idea is floated with some sales tax holidays as well. So there's concerns. I mean, no tax is perfect, and I think if we're going to proceed that, we need to acknowledge the pros and cons of each tax.
And the income tax does bring in $8.4 billion annually in Wisconsin, which is about half of the state's general fund. Representative Dano, when you first heard that Governor Walker had brought this up, was it surprising to you? Or?
Well, I think I take note that an election year is coming up, and I think this probably has a lot more to do with election year posturing than it does with any real well-thought-out policy because, like the professor just said, if you look at what it would take to increase, you would look at having to bump our sales tax up to over 13%, which is an extraordinarily high sales tax if you think about it. And, again, it would tend to hit the people – and the problem with sales taxes is they are aggressive. They tend to hit lower-income people hard. Sales tax has some elasticity too because if you – as the economy turns down and people stop buying and – for whatever reason, you're going to see a decline. And we saw that happen with the Great Recession. You're going to see a decline in sales tax numbers as well. So it doesn't it smells to me more like it's some sort of, quite frankly, a campaign year policy, campaign year politics more than anything else. I actually have my there's, I think, about 10 to 13 states around the country that don't use a sales tax. A vast majority of them that don't have sales tax have some sort of natural resource extraction-based economy like oil, or something like that. Mostly it's the big oil states. Wisconsin does not have that. We do not have that option to draw revenue from there. You look at Florida, which has a sales tax, but they have a massive, massive tourist industry. They can collect, and they also put the sales tax on rental units for people that are there, I think, less than 6 months a year. So think about that. So what they're doing is they're basically getting a lot of money from non-residents that they can essentially, who are there for relatively short periods of time and can essentially, for lack of a better term, soak them while they're there, extract that money, and then their residents don't pay. But then the residents also are paying about a 10% annual sales, a 10% sales tax on most goods. You would also potentially have to look at expanding the sales tax to services as well then, and I know that would be a very controversial issue. So I think it's more about political posturing at this point. I don't think they've really thought what the potential implications are very well. This is not a group that is inclined to a whole lot of deep thinking. When I look at what they're up to and my view of what they typically do, it does tend to be for political purposes. I have not seen policy in Wisconsin over the past couple of years being done for what I would consider good policy reasons. There tends to be there's a very political current running through most of what they do, usually engaged in messaging and winning the next election.
I would wonder, too, that if the sales tax were to raise in Wisconsin, I mean, what does that mean for border communities like La Crosse? Would that have some sort of impact on the local economy?
I think La Crescent would, the retail businesses in La Crescent would find themselves booming.
Well, definitely. I'm originally from Milwaukee, and I think there's a really unique environment in Milwaukee, especially with auto dealerships. So in Milwaukee, when the sales tax increased for Miller Park, I think what happened was all the auto dealerships left to the surrounding counties. And I think that the border effects are very important to consider. If we're going to have a much higher sales tax in Wisconsin, you've got to think Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois are going to benefit, especially along those border communities, from shoppers that are going to go right across the border.
Especially if you're talking about a huge, significant difference. You know, if you're talking the difference between Minnesota and Wisconsin, if we went to, say, 13%, which is what would be the requirement, we would be looking at about a 6 to 7% difference between Minnesota and Wisconsin. That's the kind of difference that will lead people to, especially when you're in a place like La Crosse or where I live, bordering Minnesota, the incentives are going to be there to simply cross the river. That would be, for a 7% annual or a daily difference, you're going to cross the river pretty consistently.
I think most fiscal policy analysts will say that the best strategy that one can take, that the best strategy a government can take, is to diversify your revenue base. And that means not just relying on one tax, but rather on a variety of taxes and the tax basket. So I think that's because, obviously, if one tax fails, we can rely on other taxes to kind of help get us through and cover our public services. So I think that will most likely come out in the discussion that there won't be a complete elimination of the income tax, but there might be kind of a change like what Ohio did recently in the past year or so.
Is Wisconsin diversified enough currently?
I guess it's an academic question. The literature right now is kind of developing, you know, a really good measure for what diversification means. More importantly, I think fiscal stress is a more important measure to look at. And fiscal stress can be looked at a lot of different ways, but for the most part, we want to look at revenue adequacy. Are we generating enough revenue to cover the public services that we want to deliver? So, and I think that's happening right now with our current tax scheme, and I think that that will also probably be part of the discussion with in terms of adequacy.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Today, we're talking about this year's legislative session. My guests are UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of Political Science, John Cavari, and Democratic State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau. Next, I want to talk about badger care, the ever-evolving badger care. At this point, it seems like people who are right above the 100% federal poverty level we'll have a 3-month extension for badger care. I know that there is actually a bill in the works that would allow counties to accept Medicaid funds if the state rejects them. Chris Dano, can you talk about sort of where we are at with all that? Because it is an ever-evolving issue.
Well, look, this is ultimately the result of the Walker administration's decision to decline the expansion that was offered through the Obamacare process. And I think if you simply look at what the result of that is in a nutshell, we are covering less people. About 85 to 100,000 less people are going to be insured in Wisconsin. And it's going to cost the state taxpayer more money to do that, somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million or so. So what we've done by their – and I call this the high price of ideology – by their refusal to accept the expansion, we're covering less people, costing the state taxpayer more. Cross the river to Minnesota, just like we were just talking about, they have accepted the expansion. They're adding people to their rolls. They're covering more people. And their insurance rates are substantially lower than the insurance rates that Minnesota residents are paying as part of those exchanges and all that were previously covered are substantially lower than what you'd pay in Wisconsin. That I think is the key thing to take note of, is that this would not be an issue if they had simply accepted the expansion money, worked to set up our own state exchange, and said, look, we may not agree with this, but it's the law of the land, and we're going to have to work, and we need to figure out a way to make it work best for the citizens of our state. And that's what is often a very frustrating thing I've seen over the past couple of years. There's this sort of that let's let ideology guide things instead of what good policy is, and instead of setting things aside, saying, all right, we didn't win this one. Clearly, the decisions were made, but we're going to dig in our heels and fight. And the only people it hurts are lower income people with lack of access to people that will be losing insurance. Who it benefits in the state of Wisconsin? It benefits nobody, because the average taxpayer in Wisconsin is now paying more in taxes and getting less money from the federal government than they were before. I don't see how that benefits the state at all.
John Kavari, do you have any sense as to whether or not Badger Care and Obamacare is going to play much of an issue in this year's elections? For maybe some of the state elections.
Well, it's tough because voters have a fairly short memory. So, when we're on a 24-hour news cycle, kind of the scandal of the day rules the day. But for the most part, I think voters are going to stick to their party affiliation. Democrats are going to vote Democratic. Republicans are going to vote Republican. So turnout is going to be, really important for the parties to turn out their base. So how well, if there's a 3% increase in enrollments in terms of Obamacare, is that going to, have an impact on how many Democrats vote? It might. But at the end of the day, I think it's going to be a close race either, however it rolls out.
I want to talk about some other bills that are on the table. You hear a lot about job bills and economic bills. And, last year in the legislature, there were a few bills that were addressed. Representative Dano, can you talk about the work that the legislature did when it comes to job creation? Do you think enough was done? Do you think more could be done this session?
Clearly not. The centerpiece job bill, if you look at what the Republicans were trumpeting, was the Act One, the mining bill, which basically gutted a lot of Wisconsin's iron mining and environmental regulations to make it easier to site the mine in the Pinoki Range, but which I would also remind people is a statewide bill and has potential impacts all across the state in theory. And western Wisconsin does have iron ore deposits as well, and that was one of the concerns I had. But that was their centerpiece piece of legislation, and the projected jobs for that mine were at best 10 years out probably before that mine really gets underway, if it even is permitted, which again is a real strong question because there's some real constitutional issues with that bill, which I won't dig into. But no, clearly not. And one of the things I've I noticed you guys paying attention to it too, if you look at the way you do the way you do economic development in a place is you have to take – there's some short-term approaches you can do, but you also have to take a long-term approach. I've been watching and been following for the past number of years now the differences that are going on between Wisconsin and Minnesota. Minnesota basically went a completely different direction than Wisconsin did in 2010. Not entirely, but the governor
was
different.
When it comes to taxes and job creation.
But and if you look – especially with the past session, they've really gone in a very different direction. And – Minnesota now has the fifth fastest growing economy in the country. They're looking at a $1 billion budget surplus for their state budget. They're adding money into their schools, their university system. They're making the kind of long-term investment. They're working on their infrastructure development. They're making the kind of long-term investments that really lay the groundwork to have continued long-term economic development. And whereas Wisconsin, cutting its university system, cutting its primary education system, cutting back, the only kind of real infrastructure development we're doing is roads. We're not looking at any sort of mass transit or anything like that. So we're really, in addition to not doing well right now, currently we're not doing well at all. We're 37th for job growth in the country. We're lagging behind the national recovery as a general rule. We're setting ourselves up for a long-term decline relative to other upper Midwestern states, which I find very disheartening and discouraging. And for people that – someone like me who is in this business because I love this state and want to see it do better is frustrating because you look at what the evidence is showing us and we're doing everything wrong pretty much. Again, you can argue with on some of the ultimate details, but the kinds of things you need for long-term economic development, highly educated workforce, technical competence – technical college programs, those were also cut substantially. We're cutting all the kinds of things that will ultimately lay the groundwork for future economic development, not to mention short-term economic development. So I'm not at all happy with what we've done over the past couple sessions.
John Kavari?
There's a point to be made there, definitely. And there's, I think, a fairly interesting ideological divide here between Republicans and Democrats, that Republicans believe that through tax cuts, economic development will happen because there will be more capital to invest in terms of business businesses and job creation. Now, that hasn't necessarily panned out to the extent that we would hope here in Wisconsin, just because we are kind of lagging neighboring states in job creation. Now, the alternative perspective is that, you know, we should invest more in terms of education, transportation, other kinds of infrastructure. And I think the academic literature supports this. Now, the tax cut strategy also makes sense. I mean, if we can cut taxes and yet provide the same level of services, you know, that's a good thing for the taxpayers in the state. And I think that that's a viable strategy. But when there are cuts being made, along with the tax cuts, these cuts in investments, these cuts in public services will have an impact, and they'll wash out the tax cut benefits.
So what more can the legislature do this year, and are there any plans to address some of these issues this year?
Well, we have a number of, you know, we've got a number of bills that are out there. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but there's a number of bills that will do some things that should hopefully give some boosts to some incentivizing for some new jobs. There's also a lot of credits for retraining and workforce enhancement and workforce development, which is one of the things that, I'll be honest, I'm somewhat skeptical about that. I have some understanding of basic economics. When I hear employers claiming that they can't find people to do the jobs for the money they're offering, what would basic economics tell you need to do? If you can't find somebody at $12 an hour to do the job you're asking for, raise the wage to $13. That's not doing it, you raise the wage to $14. At some point, you will find people who are willing to work for the amount of money you're offering. What it tells me is that there's a lot of employers out there that simply, and I'm being blunt, don't want to pay people, especially in some of these more skilled fields and trades. They want to lowball them. Well, and guess what those folks can do? If they have skills, they have those kinds of things that are in high demand, guess where they get to go? Where there's better money. Minneapolis, Chicago, other states. That's the kind of thing I worry about. If you have skilled trades, skilled occupations, and you don't want to pay them, they'll find somebody who will. They'll go to the places that pay them better. And you do see that. You're starting to see that in this state, and it's one of the concerns I have. We've got a lot of people in the upper part of my district that commute into work, that work in Minneapolis and the Minneapolis area and the metro area up there, that drive in because they got a better job over there. So, you know, that – but we do need to work on developing our homegrown talent, and we do need to help people that do want to do those sorts of things. But that is something that again, the emphasis has to be on developing, you know, a work folks and getting folks into jobs and helping the long-term unemployed get themselves reskilled. Now, some of those folks probably do need to get back into the market and reskill themselves. But overall, I think that's the way we need to go, is to really focus on those things.
John?
I'd like to echo that. I think mobility and connectivity is a major issue. And I think Senator Ellis has proposed a bill to create a regional transportation authority in the Fox Cities area. And I think Milwaukee is struggling with this too. The problem isn't that there aren't jobs out there. There are jobs out there, but there are job vacancies. But there aren't skilled workers that are able to connect with those job vacancies. So, for example, in the Milwaukee area, in the central city of Milwaukee, there are plenty of workers that are available to work in jobs, and yet there are transit cuts being made in southeastern Wisconsin, and they can't get out to the kind of the sprawl areas or the fringe areas of that metropolitan area. So I think that connectivity, and I think Senator Ellis is, you know, pushing for this in the Fox Valley area, that we need to connect workers with those jobs, and those businesses need to maybe start thinking about, you know, locating in an area where they can maximize their workforce.
Well, and I would add that when you look at particularly the regional southeastern Milwaukee situation with the inability to create a regional transit authority, essentially, guess who stood in the way of that when he was county executive? Our current governor. I mean, that's the kind of – and there are very political reasons for that, and quite frankly – race reasons. A lot of those, there's racial elements to that. There is a strong resistance in the suburbs to allowing folks from the inner city to be able to have access to transit that would bring them out to jobs in the suburbs. There's no getting around There's that, and there's a lot of historical baggage that goes along with that sort of stuff. But the Milwaukee metro area is one of the most racially segregated areas in the country, and because of those, some of those dynamics that, again, with regional transit. And you want to talk about regional transit, I will add one thing. I think, again, one of the decisions that will haunt this state for a long time is Governor Walker's decision to decline the money for the high-speed rail line that would have connected Milwaukee and Madison, because ultimately that rail line, the idea was to run a high-speed rail line connecting Chicago to Minneapolis. That rail line would have come through western Wisconsin, ultimately either through the La Crosse area or the Eau Claire area, more likely La Crosse.
One thing I'm trying to understand with that situation, though, is it doesn't seem like that plan is totally off the table. You know, we're hearing about the regional transit plan that's working together. Mm-hmm. The name's escaping me right now. But they are still working on this plan. And, you know, we hear about Amtrak wanting to add another line from Minneapolis to Chicago.
The question is whether it will go through Wisconsin. Now, I tongue-in-cheek, I would hope if they don't go through Wisconsin, they're going to run it up along the river because western Wisconsin will benefit from that. But I hope so. I hope they do, because that would be one of the most significant strengths Wisconsin has, is the fact we're lucky in some senses that we sit between Chicago and Minneapolis. These are two cities that are literally globally significant. They are cities that have a global footprint, that have global trade. They are global trade hubs, international airports, all the high technology that goes along with it. To be in a position to be a part of a high-speed connection network between those two cities and the synergy that will create will have tremendous economic benefits for this state. I hope we're in a position to be able to take advantage of that. Right now, we're not. And if Chicago and Minneapolis get it, they understand they will become stronger by connecting. And they want to do it. And they're going to find a way. And if they can't go through Wisconsin, they'll go down through Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois and leave us, quite frankly, as a backwater, literally, if that happens. So I hope we can get that solved. But to turn that money down, $800 million of economic development money that would have ultimately led to this connection, that will be one decision I suspect that may haunt this state for a long time.
Briefly, I want to touch on the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Yesterday, the Joint Finance Committee decided to release their second year of funding, but they're still holding on to this $35 million surplus. This all comes after an audit showed mismanagement within the agency. Is WEDIC doing enough to create jobs within the state? Are there changes needed to be made to the agency, John?
So it's WEDC, right? Not WEED is the Wisconsin Housing and Economic
WEDIC,
Development.
Yeah.
WEDIC, sorry. Yeah.
No, that's okay.
So, I think one of the big concerns is that, you know, the WEDIC should be spending the money that it's allocated. I mean, obviously with budgets, you don't want departments to run over budget and you don't want departments to run under budget too, especially when we're kind of falling below that 250,000 job mark. So I think that there's a concern there. I think that there are some investments that could be made, especially in terms of workforce training. But it's going to be something to keep an eye on for sure. And that's I know that the Joint Budget Committee voted on that yesterday. So I'm kind of interested to hear the representative's perspective.
Well, I'll be honest. I did not support the initial creation of WEDIC. I did not think there were adequate safeguards when I looked at the way they created it. I'm a former police officer, and their lack of transparency and a number of other issues really – set off a lot of alarm bells in my head. I think to some extent I was proven correct when we discovered that they weren't adequately monitoring the monies that they were handing out. My fear was that it would essentially sort of become a way to handle, instead of doing real economic policy development, it would have been more about, well, rewarding certain companies or individuals who have political connections. And that's a problem you always have when you have agencies that aren't completely transparent. That being said, I do want to see the idea work. I want there to be good economic development. And it is troubling if essentially they're not getting the money out there to do economic development. I've got a project in my district that I think WEDIC should get involved in. I've been pushing on them since for getting close to a year, well, probably 8-9 months.
What project is that?
It's a project in Black River Falls, basically fairly simple, to create a crossing point for ATVs along one of the highways, a safe crossing point, which would then create a whole series of – it's the last choke point for a series of interconnected ATV trails to all these various local businesses and things. And if we can get that in place, you're going to have a nice little connection where all these different trails where people coming off the ATV trails in the area will be able to ride their ATVs right up to all these various local businesses and patronize them. The casino, the hotels, a number of restaurants, the DNR center is part of that network too. Still waiting to hear from them on that. So I'm hoping we're going to get the and it's a fairly small amount of money, but it's like, let's get it done. So those are the kind of things we'd like to see happen. And again, that's a good example where a small little piece of infrastructure, the cost is prohibitive to the local governments. It's pretty expensive for the local governments to do, but for the state government to step in and help out with things is really something that's the kind of thing we should be doing because it will have real long-term benefits. And I hope we can get that kind of thing done.
Democratic State Representative Chris Dano represents Trempealeau, and UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of Political Science John Cavari is joining us today on Newsmakers. We're talking about the look ahead in politics in the year 2014. Coming up next, our discussion on the year in politics continues as we talk about more bills that could come before state lawmakers, as well as the governor's and state legislator area races. To hear this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. Like us at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're looking ahead at the year in politics. There's a governor's race, congressional races across the state, and a handful of state legislative races in southwest Wisconsin. But first, lawmakers have a job to do, with a number of bills up for debate. Here today to talk about top politics in 2014 are Democratic State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau and UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of Political Science John Cavari. We did invite a number of Republican lawmakers from the area and across the state to join us, but they either declined our invitation or did not respond to our request. I want to continue the discussion on a number of legislative bills that may or may not be up for debate this year. Representative Dano, you have co-sponsored and sponsored a number of frac sand-related bills that have come before the state legislature. Can you talk about those? I know they have to deal with county issues, zoning issues.
Well, in all honesty, I'm not optimistic that they'll be up for debate. I mean, the challenge with being a minority legislator is often your bills don't get heard. Which again is a frustrating thing. I didn't agree with it when we were in the majority. If a bill is a good bill and it's a good idea, or at least merits some debate, it should be debated, at least have a public hearing in committee. My focus really with this is to make sure that we have adequate regulation in place of the sand mining industry. It's a booming industry, as we know, and we've had some problems. And any time you have a new industry, which rapidly expands, you will find that both the state and local government probably does not have the personnel in place to adequately do the monitoring they need to do. And if you look at what's happened, we've had a number of violations of state law and environmental quality regulations and permits.
A number of fines have come down.
And fines have come down.
And
I want to have people in place to be able to get out there and do the enforcement, the inspections. Right now, there's just simply not enough state employees to go around and get to all these sand mines and inspect them on a regular basis. And again, if you're a good operator, if you're doing things right, you're not going to mind having inspections being done. And quite frankly, an outside pair of eyes is often a good way to find problems and that you may not be aware of and get them addressed before they become major. So it's one of those things I think is really important that we do. But the DNR is only adding, I believe, two positions, and those are only for air quality. I'd like to see more positions just to generally make sure we're making sure all environmental processes are being handled correctly. I'm not optimistic. This is, again, if you look at the history of this administration, this is not an administration that's been inclined to add regulators or to put more regulations in. They've been wanting to go the opposite way. They've been loosening environmental restrictions. They've been making it easier to pollute, making it easier to dump to deposit fill in our waterways, to destroy wetlands. So I'm not optimistic that under the current administration, the current legislature, we'll be able to get these bills to a place where they'll become law. But, you know, part of the job is you need to try and at least have the debate, have the discussion. And there's the maybe we'll catch lightning in a bottle and get something moving, but we'll see.
Why do you think that this is an issue that has such a hard time actually being pushed forward within the legislature?
You mean environmental regulation in general or the frac sand?
The frac sand. I mean, I know that there's a lot involved with the frac sand.
Well, I think part of the problem with the frac sand in some sense is it is still a regional issue. It most of it is going on in western Wisconsin.
So maybe people on the eastern part of the state don't totally understand.
If you're a legislator from northern Wisconsin or the eastern part of the state or represent an urban area, it really is not an issue that comes to mind as something that's critical to you. So that's a challenge. It is mostly the western section of the state here, into the southwest a little bit. But, you know, we're relatively low population densities here. Our numbers of state legislators aren't the same as there are in the southeastern part of the state. And so it is a little more tricky to get that moving. Again, right now, though, there is a general ideological inclination against regulation of any sort. And so I think that's in some senses a bigger challenge than the issue of it being regional.
And I hate to keep comparing Wisconsin to Minnesota, but, I mean, it is pretty clear the differences that the two states have taken when it comes to addressing frac sand mining.
Oh, very much so. And what that's also led to is it's led to a migration of these companies into Wisconsin, I think, to some extent, because there's a somewhat lighter regulation. You know, that's fine to some extent, but it concerns me, though, when you have companies that, you know, it makes me wonder what kind of actors they are if they're unwilling to comply with Minnesota state regulations, which I don't think were that – they were tough, but they weren't onerous. And if they're unwilling to comply with those regulations, it makes me wonder what kind of actor they're going to be. And that's a big part of this is if you're going to be a business doing business in western Wisconsin in the district, in the community, I hope they're good neighbors. And we want them to be good neighbors. And they all claim they want to be good neighbors, but the claim has to be met with real action.
John Kavari?
I think that there's a trade-off here between consistency of environmental policy so that, you know, every local government isn't doing its own thing and making it difficult for these companies to actually, you know, provide a service to make natural gas cheap in the United States. At the same time, there should be some local control and some, you know, fairly adequate environmental protections for our state's residents. So this is the challenge that the legislature is going to have and the DNR is going to have, and it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out.
Another bill, Representative Dano, that I see you've co-sponsored, or maybe you have sponsored, but it's regarding medical marijuana in the state of Wisconsin. This hasn't gotten much attention lately, but I'm wondering if you could talk about the mindset behind that bill.
Well, you know, really this one comes out of At one level, it comes out of the classic example of when you're a legislator, you meet people and you discuss them. One of my constituent is Jackie Rickert, the person that the bill is named after, and it's been named after for a number of years. She lives in my district. I met her. She talked to me. She contacted me when I was first running for office. And I can tell you, as a former police officer, I was a little bit skeptical.
I was wondering that from a former law enforcement agent.
But in talking with her and listening to her, It's simply about, look, this is something that can make her life and the lives of other people with some serious chronic illnesses a little bit better, reduce some of their pain, reduce some of their suffering. And why would I want to say no to that? How can I say no to that? After having met Jackie and looking at her situation and meeting other people who are in those situations, I can't say no to trying to help them. And that's really what it is and ultimately. And then if you look, you know, getting into the broader policy implications, again, having been a police officer, I'm no great fan of the war on drugs. I think it's been a failure in the long run. I think it's created a lot of problems for us as a country. It's led to the massive incarceration of a lot of people who probably shouldn't be in jail, who are in jail for nonviolent offenses. And instead we should be locking up people who are genuinely violent, genuinely dangerous, genuinely a real danger to the public. It really is, to me, should be dealt with more as a public health matter as opposed to criminal. Now, obviously, you have to have some reasonable constraints and controls. But, it's going to be interesting how the experiment goes out in Colorado and Washington State. But, to me, it's about at a policy level, dealing with that, and then just at the human level of trying to be decent to your fellow human beings who this is something they need that can relieve their suffering. And I'm not going to be standing in the way of that.
And John Kavari, we see the tide changing when it comes to marijuana laws across the country. What sort of chance does Wisconsin have at something like this actually coming to the floor?
Well, I think what I've read is that the legislative leadership really doesn't want to set this for hearings. I think what's interesting about this is that I think you're very right here. Public opinion has really changed, especially with the policy entrepreneurship in Colorado and Washington. Now, this is a topic that's really popular with my students at UWL.
I'm not surprised.
And I do an informal poll in class asking how many of the students support, you know, decriminalization or allowing medical marijuana. And far and away, it's a vast majority of the students. And I think 10 years ago, that kind of public opinion was much different. So I think the tide is changing.
How, with a bill like the medical marijuana bill, or Fraxan bills, or, you know, even this week we're hearing about the abortion bills being brought up again, how much will this being an election year impact what actually is passed within Wisconsin?
There's two approaches that I suspect the Republicans will take here. They're either going to go for what we call the feel-good, non-controversial bills that are not going to be the kind of thing that stirs anybody up. And so they can say, look, we did all these wonderful things, non-controversial, bipartisan, look at all the bipartisan support we have. Or they're going to go for the bills to motivate their base. I don't know which angle they're taking quite yet. I'm obviously not privy to internal Republican strategies for legislative and electoral strategies, but those will be the two approaches. So either they're going to decide to push the bills that really makes their base fired up and happy, or they're going to try and push the bills that, you know, like I said, are feel-good, make everybody happy bills. I suspect they're going to go for the feel-good, because if you look at the Republican brand right now, and it's one of the reasons I'm not a Republican, because I think a lot of it's generally true. They're a party that's full of – they're viewed as kind of extreme, somewhat callous, and so they're kind of viewed as being out there. Being out there on the – if you look, there's that new poll that came out that said there's been a significant decline in identification as Republicans. The Democrats have fallen off a bit too because of the partisanship, but Republicans I think are at their lowest rate in the country for party identification that they've been in a long time, down to only 28% of the total population identifies themselves as Republicans. 46% identify as independents. The losses come from people who are abandoning the Republican Party. And they've also got problems with other groups, women, minorities, pretty much anybody who's not an older white male. I think that is where you may see them go more though the feel-good route, but we'll see.
And it does even seem like Republicans within the state are divided on certain issues, like the abortion issue, like the tax issue. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
The lack of a Republican primary also, I think, is going to indicate that the party – I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, so it's really hard to say what's going to actually happen. But my theory would be that because Governor Walker won't see a significant Republican primary, that the party will go more moderate, more towards the median voter.
And there have – actually, let's talk about the governor's race now. There are a couple of Republicans who have decided they want to run against Governor Walker. Like you said, we're not sure if it's anything serious. Mary Burke has announced that she wants to run as a Democrat. There's a couple other Democrats on the ticket. Are we looking at a governor's race here in Wisconsin that is going to be – an expensive race? Is there going to be a lot of money dumped into this election? And what sort of impact will that have on everyone living in the state?
Well, I think if you look at history, this will be an expensive governor's race. Governor Walker has sort of made himself a hero to the national right wing elements of the party with what's happened over the past couple of years. So there's going to be a lot of national support flowing to him. So it will be, and politics is just generally getting more expensive. I think what you are going to see is no matter what, I think whoever runs against Governor Walker, I think it'd be a wet dish rag right now, starts with 45% support. I think Governor Walker probably starts with probably a very solid lockdown, 45% support. The battle is going to be over the next 5.1% that gets you over 50% between the, and those are the folks that tend to be often the ones that are most easily moved by media advertising, because they tend to, if you haven't made up your mind on Governor Walker at this point, you're probably not a terribly as engaged a voter, or you're just not very political. So you're the kind of person that if they can reach you with the right, they're going to do all the different kinds of things to figure out what message will reach you. And they'll be trying everything. And that means they'll be spending a lot of money to get to that 5.1%. If you're part of that 5.1%, if you're part of that 10% that's undecided, you can expect, and they can identify you, you can expect to have a lot of stuff sent your way. You probably have a lot of people knocking on your doors, a lot of phone calls, a lot of mail.
And it goes back to what you said.
A lot of TV aimed at you that is not aimed at anybody else.
But if there are an increasing number of independents, I mean, I don't know if that is independents when it comes to state politics or national politics, mm-hmm. but...
Well, so the most recent Marquette University public opinion poll occurred, I think, in mid-October. And I think for an election that's over a year away, and for there to only be, I think it was a 48 to 40, let me check my notes here, it was 48 to 45 Walker-Burke matchup with about 48 for Walker with 8% undecided. For, you know, an election that's over a year out, that's pretty remarkable that there's so few undecideds there. So in 2010, Walker raised about $10 million, and Tom Barrett raised about $5, $6 million. Now, the Feingold-Johnson race each raised about $14 million apiece. So I think that, you know, if the Burke campaign could, you know, meet the Walker campaign's expenditures there, she might close the gap, but she's got a huge name recognition issue. People don't know who she is necessarily, and I think that's going to be the challenge for the Burke campaign.
Will there be a lot of outside money coming into this election?
That outside money is now a part of American politics, thanks to our wonderful recent Supreme Court decisions. I say that with all irony. Yeah, I would expect there will be. I think you're seeing third-party money will be in a lot of any race that's considered significant, you will see third-party money. You won't see third-party money in races that people consider pretty much settled or whatever. But, there's going to be tons of third-party money coming in, I can guarantee it. And at every level, probably there's a substantial amount spent in legislative races, everything from state representative to Congress. There will be third-party money being spent.
So another person who has not formally announced that she would be running for governor, but I know she's exploring it, is State Senator Kathleen Vinehout, a Democrat from Alma. She has registered to run for her state Senate seat again, mm-hmm. but, I mean, do either of you have any insight into this decision if she did decide to run for governor?
Well, she's my state senator, so obviously I'm watching it pretty closely, but I have not had a chance to talk with her since her accident, and I know I think that may
the
have
car accident.
The car accident. It was a fairly significant injury, mm-hmm. so that may be having my only. And again, I'm purely speculating here that may have some impact on her decision. I mean, when you have a health issue, that always is family and health issues often have a major impact on your decision on what you're going to do as far as what office you're running for. I couldn't do this if my wife wasn't with me and my family wasn't with me. So, I think we're going to have. I suspect that maybe. I'm guessing from the quiet I've heard from her that they're mulling things over right now. And what the final decision would have been, I wasn't privy to. Obviously, that's her decision to make, and I wasn't privy to it. But I think we'll see. I think that was the one issue that may create a little more of a complication for her, obviously, when you have a personal issue like that with your own health.
And, John, you talked about Mary Burke not having name recognition. Does Kathleen Vinehout have name recognition across the state?
Maybe not so much. I mean, she's obviously a regional,
Everyone around here knows who
character,
she is.
Right. Yeah. Right. But maybe less so in, Brown County and Milwaukee County and southeastern Wisconsin. So that's going to be a tough sell too, especially if there are these, health complications, which, obviously you really feel for, but I think there's an argument to be made that even Tom Barrett, was a little slow out of the gate as a result of the, attack mm-hmm. that, occurred at State Fair Park. So that was a challenge for him. I think that might be a challenge for the senator as well.
Well, you know, and if you look at, though, and the thing I keep coming back to is I think this is what people, and that's why those of us who are Democrats think Scott Walker's eminently beatable. When you look at the numbers, people, virtually anybody who matches up with him is going to, you have strong is when the dust settles and the primaries are settled, whoever runs against Walker is going to have a very solid base of support, very active, very, very dedicated base of support to work from against the governor. I think the governor is going to have his own. He's got a pretty solid base of support, but you know you are going to have a very solid base of support once you clear that primary. Again, I think that ultimately the battle comes down to there's that saying that Walker people are going to vote for Walker. The people who don't like him are going to vote for his opponent. And the people who will probably decide this are going to be the independent voters in the middle. And that's usually the way most close elections are decided. It's the folks that kind of can swing either way. It was the term they've been referred to in Wisconsin is the Obama-Walker voter, people that voted for both President Obama and Governor Walker in the recall. I discovered that when I did some of my first political work was I'd be calling up people and asking them who they're voting for. This was 2004. And they were telling me George Bush for president and Russ Feingold for Senate. And I'll be honest, I was completely mystified by that because you can't find probably two more diametrically opposed political figures. But we had a substantial number of people who were perfectly willing to vote for George Bush for president and then turn around and vote for Russ Feingold for senator.
Do you have an explanation for that, John?
Political schizophrenia is kind of it's called the legislative paradox. For some reason, people don't like the establishment. They don't like Congress, but they will continue to vote their individual, member of Congress back into office time and time again. So I think that name recognition does play a massive role. And I think so that, again, not to kind of beat a dead horse here, but the challenge for the Burke campaign is obviously going to be getting the brand out there, having a good well-crafted message resonate with the average voter. And part of that is going to be how much money she decides to pour into her own campaign. I mean, Senator Johnson put about $8 million of his own money into the Senate campaign in 2010. So that's going to be a factor. Now, the challenge for the Walker campaign, though, is obviously going to be the struggle with the 250,000 jobs goal or promise, however you want to look at it, but and how we've kind of fallen short of that goal. So there are challenges on each side. It's going to be a close one.
Really quickly, I want another pretty hot state Senate race. In Richland Center, State Senator Dale Schultz, a moderate Republican, has not officially announced whether or not he's running. There's some rumors that maybe he could run as an independent because a Democrat and a Republican has decided that they want to challenge him. Is this a race that people across the state will be looking towards?
I think so. I mean, this is a – I think that at one level this speaks to what the future of the Republican Party is. This was the guy – just a few years ago, who was the Republican standard bearer against Congressman Kine. He was the majority leader in the Senate. Now he's basically an outcast in the party in many ways.
Because he voted with Democrats.
Because he's occasionally voted mm-hmm. with Democrats on issues that he considers important to him, his district. And, I think this will be sort of a bellwether in many ways as to where Wisconsin is going. Are we going to harden into these really rigid partisan lines that Wisconsin has not really had for a long time, where you essentially have purity tests, or Wisconsin voters going to continue to support pragmatic, moderate people? I think that will be the test. It'll be interesting to see if he decides to stay in. I think if he stays in and wins the primary, it'll tell me a lot about where the Republican Party of Wisconsin is going. If he loses the primary, it will tell me a lot. If he doesn't stay in, it may not offer as much of an answer because it won't be as quite of a referendum on that approach. But believe me, Dale Schultz is no flaming liberal. I mean, he's a conservative Republican, but he just happens to be a little bit more pragmatic than this current crop of guys that are in there. So we'll see. I think it's going to be a real bellwether for us.
And Representative Dano, you are up for re-election. You have not registered with the Government Accountability Board yet.
I will be running.
Okay. Another noteworthy races. Representative Steve Doyle, a Democrat from Onalaska, is up for re-election. Representative Jill Billings, a Democrat from La Crosse. And Representative Lee Nierison, a Republican from Westby. They are all up for re-election as well. I know at least Representative Neerson, he does have a Democratic challenger at this mm-hmm. point, so we'll see what happens with that. Very quickly, any final thoughts before?
It'll be, as usual, it will be an interesting year. I do think Wisconsin, I think 2010 was an election that will have very long-term consequences for Wisconsin. I think we have a chance as we move forward to say the direction Wisconsin's going to go. I think we can choose the path that will lead us to long-term economic development and prosperity, or we can choose a path that won't. And I think a lot of these decisions will be made over these next couple years.
John Kavar, any quick final thoughts?
Conventional wisdom is that a midterm election is usually going to be a referendum on the incumbent or sitting president. And I think Republicans made huge gains in 2010. It's going to be a challenge for Democrats again in 2014. It's going to be good material for my classes and throughout the year.
John Kavari is a UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of Political Science, and Democratic State Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau joined us today on Newsmakers to talk about the outlook in politics in 2014. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Mian Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. You can also find us on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.